KaiserNetwork.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our working chairperson, Gail E. Smith, Center for American Progress.
Thank you all, and if I can ask people to please take your seats, we have some wonderful panelists here today, and again, I want to welcome you and thank you for joining our poverty alleviation session. What we're hoping to do in this first session is really grapple with one of the major issues of our times. Like, we're all disappointed that the Doha round of trade talks has not yielded results, but I think we feel equally that until we are able to establish a trade paradigm that serves the world's poor and the world's people all over this earth, we need to do as much as we can to increase the power of the producer and to focus on the world's poorest, not as objects of our charity, but as the potential for power and equity. Now, those of you who were here last time know that this is not your usual conference. This runs a little bit differently, so what we would like to do at the top is just a brief run-through of how this will work. So I would like to ask my colleague, Steve Brigham from America Speaks, to walk you through the process, and then we will be turning over very swiftly to our moderator and our panelists. So Steve, please.
Thank you, Gail. Good afternoon. Actually, I'd just like to do a quick check. How many people were actually here last year? So a good number of you, and then obviously the rest of you are here new, so it looks like we have a really great mix. You're really in for a really wonderful conference, and America Speaks is honored to be here for the second year in a row. The reason why this is unique is because of the role that you as members play over the course of the conference. Let me explain how this works. This track has six sessions over the course of today and tomorrow. And in each of these six sessions, it's divided up into three segments. In the first segment, the moderator and the panelists will discuss the key issues related to the theme. In the second segment, about a half hour in, you at the tables get a chance to deal with and talk about the a session-specific question and give us your thoughts and ideas and perspectives. And then in the third segment, the panelists and the moderator will come back up and they will respond to questions that you've submitted over the course of the first part of the session, and they will also respond to brief summaries of the discussions that you've had at the table. So this means that you'll be doing this six times. You'll have an opportunity to give input six times over the course of the next couple days. The way we do this is that at each one of your tables, there's a table facilitator who's responsible for engaging you in the conversation, capturing the key points on the computers that you see at your table, and submitting them to a theme team that is located in the back corner of the room. And what the theme team does is they will be reviewing all of the submitted comments. They'll be theming them for you in real time. They'll be putting together PowerPoint slides that Gail will come back up, and she will share you the themes from the discussions that you've had at your tables. So these table discussions are a real critical element of every single session that we're going to do here. And we need to hear your views, your perspectives, and your new ideas about giving us a better understanding of what can and should be done about these important issues that we're talking about. So last year, we did a very similar kind of thing. We had some amazing conversations at the table. So we have high expectations of what you're going to be doing at the table. So I know you guys can reach that bar. I think one of the important things that you need to think about for this year is that what we learned last year is that people learned so much from what was going on with the panelists and the moderator, but learned equally as much at the tables and the expertise that is really resident throughout this room. And one of the ways that works is that everyone at your table during the conversation has a real opportunity to speak, a real opportunity to listen, and a real opportunity to contribute. And that's the job of your table facilitator. During the first 30-minute segment, when the panelists and the moderator are talking, if you have any questions in response to what they're saying, write it down on a sheet of paper on your table, hand it to your table facilitator. They'll tap it into the computer, submit it to the theme team. And when we come back after the discussions, the panelists and moderator will have a brief chance to address a few, but certainly not all of your questions directly at the end of the session. So please prepare in this session and the sessions to come to roll up your sleeves, to listen, to participate, and give us your best in creative thinking as being a part of this year's CGI annual meeting. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our panelists for this afternoon, His Excellency President Paul Kagame, Republic of Rwanda, Jim Donnell, Chief Executive Officer, Starbucks, Fabio Rosa, Executive Director, Institute for the Development of Natural Energy and Sustainability. And our moderator this afternoon is Dr. Judith Rodin, President, the Rockefeller Foundation.
I want to thank Gail and her team for putting all this together. It's been incredible hard work, and you've been terrific to work with. Welcome to everyone to the Poverty Alleviation Working Group. It's inspiring to see so many of you here to discuss, and much more importantly, to do something about one of the greatest moral challenges of our time. I think there's agreement that there are at least two things that are critical to ending poverty. One is expanding the capacity of the poorest of the poor to feed themselves and their family, to participate when it is possible in local trade, and to ultimately participate in global trade so that inequities, further inequities, don't develop. And second, that we must tailor these efforts very, very specifically. Giving particular focus to the rural producers who comprise the majority of the world's poor. I feel your energy here today. We're here to do a lot of good work. If this room were the world's population, half of you in this room would be living on $2 a day or less. That's the daily challenge of over 3 billion people around the globe. The vast majority of those people are small-scale farmers. They lack the necessities of daily life. They lack the resilience to withstand natural and man-made disasters. This afternoon, in our first session with these distinguished panelists, we'll look at how to generate income from agriculture, which most of the world's poor depend on to survive, how to tap the transformative power of new and affordable technologies, how to create new and innovative financing mechanisms to expand access to capital and promote development, and the policies that are required to support these efforts. The heartbreaking report in the New York Times yesterday of the suicide of the Indian farmer reminds us vividly that even in countries with rapid growth, explicit pro-poor policies are needed to help direct the benefits of growth to the poor and the underserved. We at the Rockefeller Foundation are committed to addressing these critical issues. Just last week, we announced an alliance with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to spur a green revolution in Africa that will dramatically increase the productivity of small farms, significantly reduce hunger for about 30 million people, and move about 15 million people out of poverty if these efforts are successful. Our alliance committed an initial $150 million to this effort over the next 5 years. And I'd like to signal and introduce the world's great innovator and philanthropist, our partner, Bill Gates. We believe that with our combined financial and human resources and our shared passion for partnering with local populations, we can succeed in helping to reduce poverty in Africa. And now let me turn to our distinguished panel to focus on what can be done, what is being done, to invest in the power and the potential of local producers. May I start with you, Mr. President? Rwanda is home to some of the poorest farmers in the world, with limited access to global markets. I know that you've worked with Starbucks, you've worked with other companies to develop new niche markets and to increase the income of your farming communities. Can you tell us what you've been able to achieve and how you've been able to do it?
Thank you very much. First of all, realizing that many in the whole of sub-Saharan Africa, and particularly in Rwanda, up to 90% of these rural populations live on agriculture, we've tried to see how agriculture can benefit them. And one way of starting to see how they can benefit is by organizing them so that they can pool their resources. And knowing that they live on small pieces of land, particularly like in Rwanda, we have helped them form cooperatives, associations, to be able to work together. For example, in terms of coffee producers, the farmers involved in this have been organized in cooperatives and have been assisted, given money, little money, which they can use by microfinances or other organizations. In a particular case, there has been support coming in, for example, also from another side, like USAID has helped some farmers organize themselves, put up a coffee washing station. They collect their coffee, they wash it, they clean it, and they are able to sell it at a slightly higher price than was the case before. And this has gone on to cover about 40,000 families in Rwanda who are benefiting from farming and getting involved with coffee and with coffee washing stations and so on and so forth. In other areas, they have been organized also, and they are able to benefit from supplies of fertilizer to improve their pieces of land. In many cases, pieces of land that are really very small. And we have tried to see how these pieces of land can be more productive than they have been before through simple technologies and also using their variable techniques of irrigation so that throughout there they are able to produce different crops. So a combination of these factors, organization, provision of inputs, forming these associations and trying to add value to what they produce, and then government partnering with them at different levels to try and find markets for what they produce, apart from what they produce for their own consumption, we also look at what they can produce for exports. And in terms of coffee, it has been very successful, where Starbucks has also been extremely helpful in connecting with these farmers.
Fabio, let me turn to you next, if I may. Your organization is focused on bringing services to producers and making sure that the infrastructure needed for trade is also available to the very poorest of communities. Tell us how you're doing this in Brazil and what lessons we can learn.
We are doing it in Brazil, in the south of Brazil, nearby Argentina and Uruguay, and in the center of Brazil, in the northeast, and now in the north. When working in the field, it's possible to meet with small farmers, and they are very interested in improve their income generation. But at first, when we go to these communities, they are talking, we don't have access to electricity. We don't have access to phone and communications. And we would like to improve our production, but we would like to improve our life conditions. Then we develop some models to introduce this service to the people. And when they are receiving very, very fast service and very fast solutions to improve their life conditions, immediately we introduce this new moment to improve the income generation. Sometimes we have problems with the government and the bureaucracy and the banks, because they are interested only in income generation. But poor people, at first, they are interested in results that can improve their conditions of life. I have developed a team using psychologists and anthropologists, and at first, to understand what this society needs, what is the movement in economy in these societies. And after understanding these movements, we introduce technical progress and the solutions. We are working in the 80s, I developed a very, very cheap rural electrification model using steel, using small transformers and community organization. The price in Brazil was $8,000 to bring electricity to a farm. And I did the same, and the price was $400. Okay? This is only a model, and at this moment, this is a national standard, but this is not enough to serve all of people that live in remote areas, because in Amazonia, we have people in very, very remote areas where it's not possible to build and to do grid extension. After I studied this community and these communities, and we have new information. These poor communities, they have some kind of economic movements, and it's necessary to understand. For instance, they pay some money monthly to have lights using kerosene or oil, and they like to listen to the radio. And the monthly payment is from $5 to $15 monthly. Then we change the concept of the business. The business is not to sell solar panels, but to install an energy service, a small company that will provide the panels and the service, because people are interested in energy. Then this is working. But immediately after this process, we are understanding how can people use this energy to improve the income generation. Okay, this is the way, and this is working in Brazil.
Wonderful, and we'll have more time to go back to this. We have great representatives from government, from NGOs, and of course from the private sector. Jim, Starbucks is doing an extraordinary amount today as a company to tackle poverty in a number of countries. That wasn't always the so perhaps you can tell us what made the company decide to do it and how you're going about it.
Thank you, Judith. I'd first like to say, Mr. President, we are very pleased with our Rwanda Blue Bourbon. It's one of our most successful Black Avon exclusive coffees that we have had. And I had the President in our cupping room just 6 months ago, and it was kind of interesting how he favored the African coffees versus some of the Latin American other countries, but we love it. I heard last year the term black gold. And that term was defined for me as, if it truly is black gold, why are our farmers the poorest in the countries that they live in? And I think it's something that needs to be addressed. We like to think that we are. We have developed, just over the last 2 to 3 years, and enhanced, I should say, what we used to call a preferred supplier program through our CAFE practices. And the CAFE practices is a way of giving back to the farmer and creating sustainability for the environment, for the social needs, as well as for the economic needs. And we're finding that by giving back to the farmers, it's important to create sustainability for them for their families, for their communities, as well as for their coffee. And as we sit here today with 12,250 stores, our goal, and we have said that we want to get to 30,000 stores, that's probably a little bit light, but we want to make sure that we have the coffee and the relationships to do that. And by just being a procurer of coffee, it doesn't necessarily make sense. And as I sat here last year with probably about 30% of our coffee purchases going through cafe practices, I'm proud to say today that we're far north of that number. We exceeded our commitment that we made to President Clinton last year. And the end result is that our farmers are able to do things that they've never done before. And a great story, and I'll just be brief about this, was in Costa Rica, where the Martinez family was deciding or not whether to get out of the coffee business. Mr. Martinez, fifth-generation farmer, didn't know whether he should put food on the table or reinvest in his coffee crops. Through cafe practices, not only is the crop thriving, not only has he made the decision to do both, but Sylvia Martinez, his granddaughter, is the first Martinez to go to college. And when you see these kinds of impacts that you can make by giving back, when you see the relationships that extend far beyond the next 10 years for both the coffee farmer and for Starbucks, it's definitely a win-win.
Wonderful. Thank you. Mr. President, you've been successful in attracting investors to Rwanda, and clearly there must be government policies, among others, that are making that a success. How do you link those policies with other of your policies that ensure that there continues to be pro-poor investment and pro-poor growth to help the most vulnerable of your population?
Well, the government is very mindful of the fact that the rural population forms the majority of our population, and we cannot afford to have economic activities going on by only very few leaving them out of these activities. And that's why we focus on looking at what they can do best, given even the different limitations in the situation they live in. That's why, for example, when we are looking for investments in agriculture, we are looking at investments in agro-processing so that they can link up with these farmers for what they produce. And in that process, the farmers should have where to sell their products and then be able to benefit from that. But the government also has its own role to play as we encourage the poor people to work and give them this kind of support. We get involved with putting up the agricultural infrastructure. We help them establish that, like in the areas of irrigation, as I was talking about, like in research and development, in terms of looking at the suitable varieties for different seeds there in the agriculture, whether it is coffee or rice or maize and so on and so forth. We work with them in terms of how they can access fertilizers. All this comes from the policies the government puts in place, working to attract investments that will build on their variable potential or the possibilities that these majority of our people can benefit from and realize. And I think the interaction that goes on with the government policies, with the environment we put in place for the investors who are attracted to come to Rwanda, we have created peace and security in the country. We have put and managed to put in place a conducive macroeconomic environment. We encourage people to get involved in investing in areas of exports and with what is going into exports, they don't meet any taxes that would otherwise hinder them to participate in that, and so on and so forth.
Thank you. Most impressive. Fabio, sometimes NGOs complain that they don't interact well with, or that they can't get the responsiveness of government and private sector, and that sometimes it's a contentious relationship as these efforts to alleviate poverty move forward. But you're known as somebody and your organization that's been very successful in having people in the room and then mobilizing them for action, collective action, collaboratively. Tell us how you've accomplished that specifically, what you think the challenges are.
This is a hard work and will take a lot of time. But this is necessary to understand. This is the unique way. I am used to hear histories from companies that are investing in social service or doing investments in water service, energy service, but they don't have sure about their investment is out of risk, because we need very clear public policy and legal framework. Then market developer. The NGOs are market developers because we work with innovation, and we do the innovation in the field, and we prove that the innovation works well. At second, when we met with people of the government, when we are introducing the innovation, they are talking, I don't know if this work in scale, I don't know if this is possible, I don't know, we will study. But we are interested in bringing solution to the people. Then, from one side, I work creating solutions in the field and proving that this is possible. To the other side, I am used to go to Brasilia, the federal capital, and I am working like an ambassador. And I take part of my time with people in the bureaucracy and with the government and with the Congress, and introducing the new question. It's necessary to change. It's necessary to change the regulation and the public policy. Sometimes this will take 2 years or 3 years, and when you are successful, the government will change, and we will have new governors. This is risk. But in my mind, this is the unique way to improve the innovation and to improve solutions to the people and to the poor people. This is what we are doing in Brazil. I did the first phase, and I did a national scaling up with low-cost rural electrification on grid, using low-cost on-grid electrification. And now we are trying to introduce renewable energy in remote areas to complement this first phase.
Great, thank you. Jim, I think there's still skepticism in the private sector. So tell us whether you really can incorporate poverty alleviation into your business models and still make money.
I think you have to look at this as both a balance and a blend. You have to balance believe it or not, it's kind of something that's going on right now at Starbucks. It's work-life balance, and there's also work-life blend. And so I'm trying to get through to my organization that you can't really balance something, but you got to blend it in to get it done. And so when you balance the needs for the communities that we operate in, for our farmers, for all of our supplier community, and you balance the needs of our shareholders and the needs to continue to ramp up, you have to blend in your activities and make it all flow towards the same direction. And it's easy to say that we could be out there looking for the absolute best cost, and we're going to take this right to the bottom line, and we're going to drive our EPS up. But it doesn't balance the needs of our farmers or any of our other suppliers. And it also doesn't blend in with putting out what your long-term growth patterns are. So when we look at Starbucks, and we look at the, if it was a rocket ship with two components, one is all of the needs for the communities to give back to those communities to earn the right to grow, and the other is knowing that that's fueling that rocket, that booster, if you will, is fueling that rocket as much as the financial results that you're able to produce. And so we're finding that to create a sustainable model, it is a blend of both.
Thanks. Well, our panel will return in a half an hour. It's now your turn for conversation, but join me in saying thank you.
Jesse, this is the time where we put all of you to work and where we will have these discussions at the table. And we would like you to consider a particular question. It's fairly broad. You can take it in any number of directions. And it's a kind of what-if question. If we could do anything, and I would remind you that we have in the room some of the best minds and activists in the world on these issues, what would be the most powerful initiatives we'd put together to really get income to the poorest of producers and change their lives? And let me just tell you what I mean by that. What if all of us who could afford to do so said we would spend a few cents more to buy a women producers label for agricultural goods? What if we got some of the CEOs, leading foundations, NGOs, and community-based organizations who were gathered here at CGI together to say, we're going to identify three of the world's poorest countries and figure out how we do the kinds of things our panelists talked about this afternoon. Now, I would ask you to reflect on your own experience because you all come at this from different angles and we welcome your expertise. Our friend Arturo in the back, who introduced himself to us last night, is our stage manager. For the record, this is the first time I have ever had a stage manager. We'll be flashing you some signs here about how much time is left, and then we will reconvene. So I encourage you to go ahead and get started, and we look forward to hearing what you've talked about. So please proceed, and thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, please direct your attention to the stage, Dr. Judith Rodin.
Ladies and gentlemen, we will now be taking the next 10 minutes. I hate to break into this. As a former university president, I'm well-schooled in breaking into people's conversations around the table. So if I can have your attention, we have time while our rapporteurs are taking the discussions from each table and integrating them. In about 10 minutes, we'll hear the results of all of your conversations, and given the discussions, I know that they're going to be full of terrific ideas. We have another round of questions for our panelists that I think will also add to the debate and dialogue as we go forward. Let me start with you, Jim, and ask more explicitly, what are some of the powerful initiatives that could bring greater income to producers at the bottom end of the chain, and how do you create this kind of virtuous cycle where everyone wins?
From where we sit at Starbucks, I would tell you that the most powerful initiative or initiatives that we can do is share the information that we have, the support that and the sustainability that we are helping our farmers develop with other buyers of coffee. And it's at the end of the day, we buy the world's best quality coffee, and we pay a premium price for our coffee, and through cafe practices even more so. But I think to really answer that question, I'll go back 18 months ago to Costa Rica at a dinner that was hosted by one of the directors of one of the co-ops. And he said, I want to tell you about the Starbucks effect. And he said, the Starbucks effect over the last 3 years, excluding Starbucks' purchase of coffee, was $60 million. The halo that you created caused other companies to understand what a premium price does for them and for us. And he went on further to say that $60 million could feed everybody in Costa Rica for a year. It could build 6,000 homes for the workers. And so when you look at that effect that you can do by just letting people know the good that you are creating and also the type of product that you're getting, I think is a great step.
Other industries, other products, ideas that are generalizable?
Well, I have to think about that. I'm just got out of a board meeting, so I'm kind of thinking about Starbucks. So let me think through that.
Great. Fabio, you're working on low-cost electricity. Taking that experience, and let me ask you a more generalizable question if I can. There are so many new innovations in science and technology coming. How are we going to tilt those new innovations towards the poor and vulnerable? How are we going to make sure over and over again that that happens?
I think the new technologies are only part of the business. When I think in improve the quality of life of people in the isolated areas and poor people, I am thinking simultaneously in economic democracy, a large number of small entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurs, associations, organizations, and business. I am thinking in improve the regulation and public policy, and like a training center, schools for replication, training and capacity building in business models, management models, legal framework, technology, and financing. At this moment, we have a lot of good experience. The question is how to replicate it. And then it's necessary to create new entrepreneurs and social entrepreneurs.
A difficult one. Mr. President, how can women in particular be empowered to provide opportunities for income generation in rural communities? We know that throughout Africa, many of the farmers are women, and yet many will argue that they're not empowered in ways that allow them to hold that income and use it in ways that benefit their families and certainly that stimulate growth. Are there things government can do? Are there things civil society should be doing? But how can we move that agenda that seems to be lagging forward?
That's a very good question. In the case of Rwanda, 52% of our population are females, they are women. And we realize that this is a very huge section of our population, leaving them out of economic activities in any way or out of education, like has been the case in the past or is the case in many countries, is a big mistake. And we have, therefore, in our case, tried to involve women at different levels. We have provided for women education now without any discrimination, like in the past where government was not involved like it is today, for example, in the provision of universal primary education. The rural poor families where there is little income, they would prefer if they have two children, one is a boy, another is a girl, the immediate choice would be to carry the girl to stay behind and maybe struggle to take the boy to school. But what we do today is to take all of them to school. That one is extremely important. Number two, with the education, therefore, covering women as they should, we have also to look at the laws that have been in place for a long time that, in actual fact, disempower women directly. And most of these laws have been changed to accommodate the needs of women and to be able to empower them. Like, for example, the law on inheritance. In Rwanda, women could not inherit anything from the families. And this is an old law that was in place that is linked with the colonial times, and we have since changed that, and women can be able to inherit. And with education, with the laws changed like that, with women who can also have land titles, they can have land to do different productive activities, with women encouraged to participate at different levels of our government, at the local administration level, at the central administration, at different levels, and being encouraged to also become entrepreneurs and having access to, or say, similar access, equal access to whatever opportunities that are there. This has raised the status of women and has given them the opportunities they deserve to have, and in the end, the nation has benefited. So it's something that, like you said, today our own parliament has nearly 49% women representatives. So really, the women participating directly as they are today has benefited the country very visibly. It wouldn't have been the case if they hadn't been involved and if different efforts are not being taken as we have done.
Well, that parliamentary equality is a worldwide model. Jean Sperling mentioned at our table that we ought to be thinking also about building more entrepreneurship into the agricultural efforts. We've been supporting efforts to train women in rural villages to become what we call agro-dealers, women who sold soda and crackers in their local villages and now have become trained to sell seeds and fertilizer to advise and educate the local farmers, and are developing the kind of entrepreneurial role that we think really will benefit and continue to lift people out of poverty. And I know that you've been developing also a terrific model for entrepreneurship, particularly among women. Baskets, we know many, many products now being developed for the world market in Rwanda that focus on women and their opportunities. Maybe one more question for anyone on the panel. There's a lot of focus and so much attention on microfinance and as one of the elements in this whole formula, and not as much conversation about microinsurance. And yet when you think about the natural and man-made disasters, the kinds of environmental and weather-related issues, health-related issues, is it going to be necessary to be as creative on the insurance side as it has been on the finance side to lift the poorest of the poor? Yes, if you could.
Yes. Well, I think that would be very necessary on the part of insurance. And for example, in Rwanda, what we have try to encourage that, especially in specific areas of health insurance that tends to cover called mutuals, tending to cover the ordinary people to be insured in terms of their own health. Certainly that is for us the starting point, as well as combined with those possibilities of provisions of microfinances for them to be able to engage in certain activities, cover their own health costs, And while the government has been sharing and contributing more in terms of education, we think that combines well to uplift the living standards of the majority of our people.
Any other thoughts on this?
No, I think that it's that I agree with the president wholeheartedly. It's also a relationship that you're building, and by creating a sustainable environment, this sustainable social needs, you're building schools, you're creating, and a great example is when Hurricane Sam went through Guatemala, they didn't have any type of insurance, but through CAFE practices, we actually stabilized the property, stabilized the crops, the coffee was intact, and we were able to help them through building of bridges and infrastructure, but the product itself was just in great shape, but it definitely is something that we need to look at as well as with microfinance.
Any insurance practices that you've seen in your communities organizing around electrical needs?
Yes, I think we are talking about the same thing. In Brazil, at this moment, we are studying a public fund where the connected people that pay monthly value for the electricity service will send 10 cents of dollar to this fund that will finance the electricity access to 24 million of people, like access to electricity. In agriculture, this is important too. When we are talking about this, we are talking about the security of the production, because in agriculture you can lose in 1 year what we did in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. So this, I think, this is necessary to develop a mechanism. And in this situation, the government and the public policy is very important, very clear. I think other sectors of the society can help in this fund, but this is very important and decisive. When we are talking developing agriculture, it's necessary to consider microfinance and microsecurity.
Well, Gail, you are ready, so I will turn this over to you.
Thank you, and thanks again to our panel. And we are going to keep our panel with us for some reactions to this. You'll see up on the board shortly our synthesis of what some of the table discussions have been. These look quite good. Let me also inform you that we have some people in the back taking copious, and we have not too creative, notes. And so we will be able to capture a lot of the discussion that may not be covered in exact detail in these, so we can continue through the course of the year to pull out some of the best ideas. I think in terms of commonalities in the discussions, people pointed to three things that are necessary ingredients for success in getting to the poorest producers. Education, access, whether it's access to finance or technology, and fundamental rights, particularly legal rights and the rights to prove their ownership of poverty. There was a lot of discussion for the need of a fairer trading system and to expand the breadth of fair trade products, but also to look for efficiencies all along the supply chain, to look for real results, and I think importantly, to listen to the producers themselves. We had a couple of initiatives that we pulled out that we thought we were interesting to share with the group. One is the notion of creating and selling long-term bonds to support local finance infrastructure. And the second is something called frequent farmer points, which I have to say I like the sound of quite a bit, of applying creative consumer incentives to developing world products, which is a really interesting idea if you think about it. Now, what will happen next? I'm going to turn back over to Judith for some final remarks for our panelists. We're then going to move to some commitment announcements in our second session. But I thank you all for your feedback. We'll continue to work with it. And Judith, the microphone is yours again.
Thank you. Let me ask our panelists then to react to these lists of recommendations, of comments, of interesting points of view with regard to what's next, what's important, which of these sparks your interest and your willingness to comment.
It's a lot of reading, 2 minutes here. But I got to tell you, as I go through, all of these are extremely powerful. And as I just went through the second page, we don't hear enough about the good stuff that's being created out there. And I think one tends to follow examples. And as I see some of the things that we're doing and some of the things that we as a company are looking at doing, following some of the other leaders in the industry, I think that bringing these stories together actually helps create results. And by telling more success stories than telling what the issues are, and you have to address the issues as well, I think you create some positive momentum.
Other comments?
Well, I agree. I think there are a number of issues that have been raised here that are extremely important. And for the rural poor, who are the majority, apart from these, I think they would benefit from an environment of good governance that has to be established in every country, and governments have to play a big role in this, where they play that more as enablers of all these things to happen, or providing the environment in which these activities should happen to benefit those majority of our people. I think one, because you'll find in every situation, I hope if you look at all this, we are talking about people, and we are talking about therefore nations or a lot of people put together, and certainly issues of governance will help most of these to happen. And if governance issues are bad, then if governance is bad, then all these things will go wrong. So governance at different levels and involving these people will make most of these activities happen if the governance is good.
Fabio?
I think these suggestions, they are right, fully. But I think too, in the South Hemisphere, we produce without subsidies. This is a very important difference. When we are talking about agriculture in the South Hemisphere, at first we are talking about to being sustainable. Sometimes we have profits. This is a very, very important difference. It means this way, organic agriculture and a very, very developed technology on environmental technology. Second, it's necessary to consider how to survive without the government, because sometimes we don't have public policies in agriculture. This is important too. And then I think it is important to organize these models and to improve and doing this scaling up of technology and business models, and to organize the civil society, and sometimes doing partnerships with the government and the big enterprise.
Thank you. If I can summarize then a very rich and full discussion, let me say that what we've heard is that it begins with great ideas and great opportunities. Without these kinds of fertile ideas and the opportunity structure, nothing will happen. It then requires capacity building for sustainability. None of this really will succeed without building in the kinds of capacity that in one way or another we're all trying to promote and we've been talking about. Third, it requires working all along the chain from access to communication to the development of markets. And fourth, most importantly, to the right kinds of governmental policies. We've talked about good governance. That tends to be a catch-all phrase. These are very nuanced and sophisticated policies that need to come from the governments themselves, from agreements among governments that ultimately will provide the kind of opportunity for people and allow millions and millions of people to be lifted from poverty. Thank you for your great ideas and for being here. Thanks to the panel.
Thank you again to our panel and to Judith. In between sessions now, we want to recognize some of the extraordinary work that USCGI members have done and are doing by recognizing some of this year's new commitments. And in introducing our sponsor at lunch, I said there are sponsors and there are sponsors. It is also true that there are bosses and there are bosses. My former boss is a boss, a colleague, a friend, an advisor. He has been a champion of the Clinton Global Initiative, an inspiration and a guide to all of us working on this team both this year and last year. So it is my honor to present our colleague and my friend Sandy Berger to present our commitments for the Poverty Alleviation Track.
Thank you, Gail. This initiative is about creative thinking and attentive listening, which we've been doing for the last hour and we'll be doing throughout the next 2 days. But at its heart, it's about the concrete steps that each of us undertake to realize these goals. And we want to single out four of those commitments at this point, and we'll do so at various points during the next 2 days. I'd like William Abrams, the president of Trickle Up Program, to come up on stage. Let's see. I'm going to get your... There we go. William, the Trickle Up Program commitment is to assist promising entrepreneurs through a Second Steps financing and training program to raise income, create jobs, and strengthen poor communities. We estimate the value of this commitment to be $1 million over 3 years. Trickle Up is creating Second Steps to help entrepreneurs who have been particularly successful in the organization's core program offered in Africa, Asia, Latin America, which provides seed grants to emerging business people. Second Steps participants will receive additional access to credit and advanced borrower business training developed specifically for people with low literacy. To be eligible, participants must demonstrate that they have a clear path for business expansion and that additional growth will improve the lives of children or others in the community. This ensures whole regions can benefit from the poverty reduction program. Bill, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Doug.
We want to, Gail, do we want people to sign these certificates? Come here and sign. I want to make sure. I got a pen right here. I'm not taking any chances, sir. Very good. Thank you.
Thanks again.
Why don't you hold that?
All right, now we're ready. Thanks.
Thank you.
You may need this.
I will. The second commitment I want to highlight, and I'd like to have Dana Frere, from co-chairman of the board of directors of the Global Partnership for Afghanistan, come up to the stage. Thank you, Dana. The commitment of the Global Partnership for Afghanistan is to develop successful small farm orchards and woodlot businesses to reduce poverty, provide sustainable sustainability to livelihoods, and to protect the environment in Afghanistan. And this is a commitment which should be valued at about $800,000 over 2 years. GPFA will partner with farmers to launch 100 commercially viable orchard and woodlot businesses, each projected to generate enough income to sustain a family of eight. The partnership will develop an appropriate microfinance package to assist farmers in financing the cost of trees and other inputs, and will facilitate the formation of farmer associations to enhance cooperation among producers. Altogether, GPFA plans that project participants will plant 1 million fruit and poplar trees. GPFA will promote the sale of high-value crops to earn farmers a profit beginning after the first year. Dana, thank you very much. I'm going to let you sign this. Put this away and have you sign it so you can't renege. Thank you very much. Okay. Let's put this up here. Thank you, Dan, very much. Thank you for your commitment. Could I ask Gene Barreau to come up? Who's the COO of InterNews Network, and we heard from Jim earlier about how you communicate, how the news gets out of good works. This commitment ensures that poor and people in crisis get the information they need to stay safe by building local language news and information capacity around the world. And it's valued at $2.2 million over the next 3 years. Specifically, Internet News Network's new humanitarian media assistance program will conduct workshops around the world in impoverished areas and conflict zones to bolster local media's ability to respond to emergency. The organization will maintain a stock of communications equipment and a group of humanitarian journalists that can rapidly be deployed to regions in strife. The organization will also help repair local media infrastructure during and following crises. Gene, thank you very much for that commitment. And I will get you to sign this. That's Hernando's. You can sign Hernando de Soto's, but he'd probably be better if he signed it himself. Thank you so much. And if I could invite one of the world's great fighters for the cause of helping poor and disadvantaged Hernando de Soto to come up. Of course, we know Hernando's leadership in the UNDP. This particular commitment involves a commission on legal empowerment of the poor and involves drafting and implementing practical reforms to help entrepreneurs in developing countries establish, operate, and expand their businesses with legal rights, a $315,000 project over 21 months. The commission that Hernando has agreed to establish will form working groups that bring together practitioners and experts in property rights, entrepreneurship, access to justice, and labor rights. The groups will pinpoint impediments to legal business entry, operation, expansion, and exit. They will then draft recommendations on how to overcome the impediments, increasing entrepreneurs' access to credit, limited liability, contracts, and information systems. The commission will organize conferences and consultation processes across East Africa, South Asia, and Latin America. Mr. DeSoto, thank you very much. Ask you to sign that. Up
Thank you so much. The last thing I would say is that many of you have already determined what your commitment is going to be going forward for the next year. But one of the reasons, some of you are still in the process of thinking about what that commitment ought to be. And one of the reasons why we've chosen a few of these commitments to be highlighted is so that you can be thinking, as you listen to those, about whether these programs are ones that you want to participate in and amplify what these people and these groups have agreed to do by your own participation. So I hope that you listen to those kind of commitments, both with gratitude for the people who are making the commitment and with potential interest on your own part. Thank you.